Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money audio commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2:25 p.m. That is on Friday, January 6th. And today being Friday, of course, is the big picture long-term video audio for the various different asset classes. And this is a rather interesting time because there are a number of the major stock market indices flirting with big psychological levels. You have the Dow Jones closing in on 20,000. You have the Nikkei closing in on 20,000. The CAC in France is closing in on 5,000. The Nasdaq Composite has cleared the 5,500 level, but the Nasdaq 100 is closing in on that 5,000 level as well. Perhaps interesting from the perspective of UK subscribers is that the FTSE 100 has cleared 7,000. And it is at, and I'm pretty sure that it is at new all-time highs. And that is something that we haven't seen for a fair amount of time. That it, we had it at the beginning of 2015, but it was not sustained. And we've had a very lengthy consolidation in the region of the upper side of this very lengthy trading range, which has prevailed since late 1999. And now the FTSE 100 is breaking on the upside. And it is not simply because the currency is weak. Now the currency is weak. It has been, it has had quite a substantial depreciation over the last 6 months. But it has been largely inert for the last 3 months, and it is a bit weaker in here right now. But when we look at the stock market, then the fact that it is loaded with these big international companies would suggest that there is something to this, the fact that a lot of these companies are leveraged to economic growth. And the potential is that we've been in a world for much of the last decade where we've had pro-cyclical policies. Perhaps the only region that has not employed pro-cyclical policy has been the EU. What they should have done was open the spigot wide in order to combat the deflationary impact of the sovereign debt crisis. And it just occurs to me that there's a Freudian slip. You can either say sovereign debt or sovereign death. And certainly there is what we are seeing is that governments are falling. That they are reaching their natural expiry, and of course they consider it an unnatural expiry date, and that is the way of all politicians. But Europe employed this fiscal consolidation, which was about as counter cyclical as you possibly could go. They have, despite the fact that they have been in this incredible funk, they have just voted for more of the same. What they really should have done was to employ massive monetary and fiscal spending. Of course, if you were to then think about when would be the best time to employ counter-cyclical policies, then this would be a pretty good case for doing it today in the USA. And yet that is extraordinarily unlikely following the presidential election. What we have seen today is that the wage growth has broken out. And that is something that is directly inflationary. We are already in the US at a point where we have full employment, wages are beginning to rise, and the labor participation rate, which is historically low, is beginning to improve, which means that the unemployment rate did not improve even though wages are rising, which would suggest that the higher wages are starting to encourage previously discouraged workers back into the workforce. And what we are now looking towards is the potential for the rationalization of the tax system, deregulation of the banking sector, and even potentially a $1 trillion fiscal spend in the US. So these are incredibly pro-cyclical developments and likely to lead to inflation. When we look at the bond markets, there is a big argument just exactly what is about to happen. We have had a substantial run-up in yields. The yield was close to 1.25 in the middle of last year. That was a new all-time low, and it has just about doubled since then. So this has been a really quite impressive sell-off, and pretty similar in magnitude to what we saw during the taper tantrum in terms of the move in the yield in absolute terms. There is a difference now, though, and it is that the Fed is raising interest rates, and the Fed is raising interest rates because that wage chart has broken out. It was not breaking out in 2013. There was no great pressure on the Fed to raise interest rates at that point because they did not yet have any evidence that they had self-sustaining growth. But perhaps we conclude that they do have that evidence today. Therefore, we can look at this chart and say very, very short term that there is an overbought condition, an overextension relative to the trend mean, and therefore there is the potential for a range in consolidation which would allow that overextension to be closed. But we are in a different macro environment today than we were 3 years ago, and that is because the Fed is raising interest rates. And that is very different. The sometimes it is really just worth looking at the chart of the Fed funds rate, because you really don't get very many charts that go sideways and do nothing at all for such a prolonged period of time. And considering that zero is, and we have already seen this last year that there were experiments with negative interest rates elsewhere, but not in the US, that we have seen the low, and that now it is only a question of how high rates are going to move. And of course, that is having a direct impact on the dollar. Now, a lot of this news is not strictly new. It has, to one extent or another, been priced in. So we have had a substantial move in the dollar already. And that would suggest that in the short term, we are now due some consolidation. And if we just look at it on the daily chart, then there has been some profound volatility just over the last 3 days. It's a big move to go from 104 to 101 and then back up to over 102. But it is reasonably similar to the move that we saw for the end of November and the beginning of December. It continues to look like a consolidation in the region of the upper side, and it's really above a lengthy underlying trading range. When we look at it over the really long term, then there is ample potential for the dollar to improve from here. The last time we had a big bull market in the dollar between early 95 and really all the way through to 2002, then we can look at this chart and say that the bull market or the breakout didn't really occur until last year. We have been through a ranging phase, and that generally speaking, the dollar can be expected to go up and then range for a while. That is what we've seen previously. The big question is whether we're going to get a bull market similar to what we had in the 1990s, or whether we're going to get a bull market similar to what we had in the 1980s. And that would be a much bigger bull market. And of course, it was driven by the fact that that inflation was falling faster than interest rates. And that really was very beneficial indeed for investors in US dollar assets. So we and of course, that big bull market in the early 1980s ended with acceleration and multilateral intervention. And I think it is safe to say we are a long way from multilateral intervention. The US is raising interest rates, and just about nowhere else is raising interest rates. And therefore, it has the potential for interest rate differentials to move in its favor. That is a, and there are really only two things that that you can regard as fundamentals in the currency markets. One, of course, are interest rate differentials, and the other is whether the central bank is on your side. And as David has said for decades, happiness in currency trading is having both the central bank and the trend on your side. And if wages are rising and there is the potential for all these pro-cyclical fiscal policies and regulatory policies to be implemented, then the Fed will be raising interest rates. And that is probably going to suck money in from all over the world in order to benefit from the stability of the US markets and that positive interest rate differential. And that is one of the primary reasons that we're seeing this continued bull market on Wall Street. And there is a clear rationale for why the US should be outperforming. And it is quite clear that it has an energy advantage, it has a technology advantage, but it has also had the fact that the Fed was so very quick to implement a counter-cyclical strategy and to print like crazy when it was absolutely required. The question is now whether it will also raise interest rates into an accelerating environment, especially when we have very clear pro-cyclical policies being implemented by the political class. When we look at this chart of the S&P 500, then it has been a clear breakout from a well-defined trading range, and despite the fact that this was a much larger range relative to that very impressive trending phase that we had between about 2012 and 2015, this is still an impressive breakout, and I think it is interesting to look at what are the sectors that are performing best so far this year. We are only 1 week into the new year, and the S&P 500, and these of course are the smaller sectors. Copper index is leading on the upside. Oil and gas drilling is up there as well. Internet retail, so that would be Amazon, is doing rather well. And what I have seen today, and I was very much reminded of the how inert the Fed funds rate chart was. And I was looking at Energy Resources of Australia, and it was also an incredibly inert environment, but it is now breaking up, and that is a substantial move. So the ASX have queried the company as to why that has occurred, but I think then we can look at the uranium sector. And if we look at the uranium sector, then we get a high degree of commonality. There is a substantial number of uranium miners are breaking on the upside. And it isn't limited to any one particular geography because it is Australian, Canadian mines that are really turning to outperformance. And Cameco, which has been, which remains by far the largest, has been leading on the upside following really quite deep overextension relative to the trend mean and an acceleration lower all the way through until the beginning of October. But there is very, very clear commonality right across the sector. And part of the reason for that is because so many of these uranium companies had gone bust, that uranium prices are at levels that are uneconomic, and therefore it is only the most established producers are likely to survive in this environment. This is turning back into a supply inhibited environment, so there is the potential for uranium prices to at least close the overextension relative to the trend mean, and there is potential for the very depressed levels to that are present in the uranium mining sector to move up again. And of course, this is pretty similar to what we see at the beginning of most years, that we get people are starting to look around for what's cheap. And there really isn't that much that's cheap. So uranium, having been so very oversold into the very end of last year, represents a candidate for a bounce. And that is certainly now occurring. It's probably worth looking at a copper mine when we see that it is the copper market that has been doing best so far this year. So that is Freeport-McMoRan finding support in the upper side of the underlying trading range, and that was following a pretty impressive advance and a lengthy consolidation for most of last year. But relative to where this share has traded previously, we are still at really depressed levels. And of course, that is also true for copper itself. Copper prices are still really quite depressed, but that was a very clear breakout from a pretty well-defined trading range in October, and we are still, I guess, consolidating. And if we just really look at that on the daily chart, we can see that it is a reasonably well-defined consolidation, but there is still perhaps some of that overbought condition relative to the trend mean that needs to be still unwound. But the fact that it is holding higher prices beyond the very short term would suggest that this is potentially a first step above that 1 year base, and that we can still look at 2017 as a potential another year where industrial resources will do better. And that is pretty typical, that generally speaking, after a big bull market has been going on for a while, that it is depressed sectors that and not least in the basic resources area that turn to outperformance last and are among the best performers in the latter stages of a big medium-term bull market. And I do think that it is very important to differentiate between a secular bull market and a cyclical bull market, because I think we have both right now. We are in the latter stages of a cyclical bull market and the early stages of a secular bull market, and they just tend to coincide at present. If we go back and look at the S&P 500, but not simply over the very short term, but look at it over the last 50 years and then look at it on a log scale, we can see clearly that even massive bull markets like that between the early 1980s and the late 1990s have been punctuated by recessions, have been punctuated by big medium-term corrections, and yet higher levels were sustained overall. Progressions of higher major reaction lows were sustained, and despite the fact that you went through lengthy ranging phases, and on occasion those ranging phases lasted for years, that you get a generally benign environment overall. And I think that that is what we are in experiencing right now, because we have had a phenomenal bull market from the 2009 low. There is no evidence that it's over. In fact, we've just had a breakout. But I don't think anybody is lost on the fact that it began in 2009 and we're at the beginning of 2017. So it is a pretty lengthy expansion as far as expansions go. We know what a top will look like. So when we look at a breakout like this, we can ask simple questions. Is there any evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend endings? And we have to conclude no. It has not accelerated. Certainly there was a loss of momentum, but that range has been resolved on the upside. And has it turned into this big volatile trading range defined by ranging time and size? No, it hasn't. And therefore, what we have had is that a previously very consistent period moved into a much lengthier ranging and more volatile phase, and that range has been resolved on the upside. And that is very characteristic of a bull market. This market will either accelerate higher, it could potentially accelerate higher, and then move pull back and have a medium term bear, which could lead to a number of years of ranging before the secular bull market environment kicks in again. I think it is unlikely that we see 666 on the S&P again ever. I think that's really a very important point, that really was the last time that we were going to see that index testing the lower side, back down to the lows that were seen after the dot-com bubble burst. If we then begin to think about how long are secular bull markets, then they can go on for over 20 years. And this one has only broken out in the last 3 years. So then we can think that, yes, there is potential that a medium-term bull market could end in acceleration, and that will be an opportunity for profit-taking, but only insofar as it is an opportunity to sell high and to buy it back lower, because then we are unlikely to get the kind of big bear market that I think a lot of people were probably hoping for. There was not many people had the opportunity to buy in March of 2009, and more particularly in October of 2008, when a lot of the leading sectors in this bull market since bottomed. When we actually look at the Dow Jones, it gives us a very, very clear example. Because if we look back over the last 50 years and then we look at when did the big breakouts occur, I'm going to take off that moving average because it's skewing the chart, then we had the big breakout in 1982, but it wasn't really until the price had pulled back that we got the low in valuations. And what we are seeing now is that margins or that profits have been trending higher in a similar pattern to the stock market. So they lost momentum at around the same time that the stock market had lost momentum. This isn't updated particularly often, and then it is updated with a quarterly lag. When this is updated, I think it's going to be on January 27th, we can anticipate that it will be breaking on the upside, that corporate profits will be improving, that we have gone through, and this is a graphic representation of the earnings recession that a lot of fundamental analysts have been talking about, that realistically we haven't had profits improving for really since 2012. And that is a good part of the reason that the stock market started to lose momentum from about 2014 onwards. In order for fundamental analysts to be encouraged by the breakout, then they have to see profits improving. And there is a realistic possibility of profits improving if we do get deregulation of the banking sector. The fact that the regional banks index is breaking on the upside and is at new all-time highs is something that I think really we can't underestimate. Now, of course, this has been an incredible advance. It's an accelerated breakout from a lengthy, volatile trading phase. There was an explosion waiting to happen. We have had the explosion. We are now getting some consolidation of that. But it's unlikely to be anything other than some consolidation. The fact that you are moving from a business unfriendly to a business friendly administration in the US is a very big deal. And it suggests that we do have short-term overbought conditions, that there is the potential that we get some consolidation, but the medium-term bullish environment is still very much intact. And it is the secular bull market is being driven by technological innovation, most particularly technological innovation as it is applied to the energy sector and the healthcare sector. And there are some profound enhancements coming down the line, not just in renewable energy, but in energy storage, not just in healthcare, pharmaceuticals, but in genetics and individualized medicine. And these are the kinds of enhancements that can really help out with the bond problem. Because we have had the quantity of debt that has been taken out explode. And it has not contributed to inflation. That the Fed's balance sheet is at $4.4 trillion. And it makes a nonsense of the rather paltry figures that it was at back before the credit crisis. Part of the reason that we have not had inflation is because the velocity of money has been going down. The velocity of money has been decreasing since 1997. And that is as a direct consequence of the disintermediation that's associated with the internet. And considering what we can anticipate, for example, if what is done if what has been done to bookstores, to video stores, to record stores, is done to doctors, or is done to filling stations, or is done to car dealerships, then there is the potential for that velocity to decrease even further. And these are not, if we think about it, Tesla does not have dealerships. Tesla has stores. At malls, they simply park an example vehicle outside. They park their test drive vehicles in the mall's parking lot, and you can use one of those to take a test drive. But there is an enormous push going on for automated autonomous vehicles. That's part of the reason that Nvidia has been doing so very well. It's also part of the reason that Mobileye has been doing a little bit better recently, that it is beginning to garner interest from some of the German automakers, that Apple has been investing heavily in its computer vision developments. Google has the Waze app so that they can track where you are, they track where everybody else is, and then they give you an individualized route or route for wherever you want to go. And of course, it is totally dependent on a hive of Waze users all using the same app at the same time in order to do that. But it's a great example of how automated vehicles are likely to work. They'll all be able to talk to each other, they'll all be able to talk to the cloud. And we continue to think about cars, but what we also have to remember is that there is the Jevons paradox. And the Jevons paradox states, or at least points towards the fact that we are living in an energy-intense economy, that the health of the economy is largely linked to an increasing energy intensification. And that also means that prices move in cycles, that when prices are high, consumers have to economize. They have to come up with ways to be more efficient. And it also gives an incentive to producers to join in and invest in additional supply. That combination of additional supply and efficiency drives prices lower eventually. When prices are lower, then it forces the producers to become increasingly more productive, to become much more efficient, and it allows the consumer to be much more to have a much more largesse with the available supply. So people think of different ways in which to use energy. They get more imaginative with how they use energy. And I've seen a number of reports that say that the number of vehicles on the road would decline when we have autonomous vehicles. And I think it'll be rather the opposite. I suspect that we are going to have substantially more vehicles on the road, and we're going to have much larger vehicles on the road. Because if you no longer have to sit behind the wheel and drive, then you could be doing anything else. You could have, and then of course, you could have an RV. It would simply be a roaming vehicle, but of course, it wouldn't be an RV, it'd be an RR. Be a roaming room. It would the your autonomous vehicle would simply be an extension of your home. It would give the potential for each of us to have an additional room to our homes, simply a room that moved and took us where we wanted to go, picked us up from where we were and ferried us back to bed. It would give a whole new potential view or a potential re-evaluation of trailer parks. It would cause a re-appraisal of real estate values. It would also question whether we would need parking structures at all, or whether we would need even more parking structures because the rush hour is not about to disappear. And those are the kinds of things that will contribute to deflation. Those are inherently deflationary because there is the real potential that they could simply knock out the current range of automotive dealerships, and then they could also promote the interior decoration sector and the customization sector, because cars are there are a large number of different brands. But then there are an infinite number of people's design for customization when it comes to their homes. And the car could just become an extension of the home. I suspect that that is even the most likely scenario. And it would suggest then that we're going to have an additional move lower in the velocity of money. And then there is this evolving experiment that is going on, because if the if velocity of money is going lower, then the pressure is then on to the central bank to enhance the not only the supply of money but the supply of money to where it can get spent. And that is the experiment that we are getting right now is in fiscal spending, but there is even more, and I think that it is the socialist solution to have universal basic income. And I think that there is some very real danger that universal basic income will be introduced, and it will be inherently inflationary, because if everybody has the same income and that income is 25% above what the Social Security is now, then prices will simply rise to bring the cost of a marginal existence higher. So that is something else that would could potentially move us into a much more inflationary environment. But inflation would be welcome, because the pace of technological innovation is so deflationary that we're going to need inflation in order to kind of balance out the very real pressures that are coming from the technological front. And I think, you know, we are all going to have to adapt to what is an increasingly new reality. If Wall Street is doing very well, then you know, it is worth looking at some of the other big indices. So the Euro Stoxx index is really only halfway through its very lengthy trading range overall. The DAX index has been one of the very few in Europe that has broken on the upside, and it has quite clearly broken a medium-term progression of lower rally highs. There are continuing outstanding problems in the Eurozone, and they are most particularly evident in the bond markets. It is the sovereign debt crisis that has just refused to go away because they refuse to deal with the outstanding debts. Portugal is a very good test case because if that were a stock or if that were a commodity, we would be inclined to buy it. And the yield on the 10-year is at 4%. The fact that it has held that 4% level and has been trending higher since August would suggest that the ECB is not buying Portuguese bonds. Now, there might be a reason for that. They might already own their quota for Portuguese bonds because Portugal is such a small economy and the ECB has created rules that it can only buy the bonds of countries respective to their GDP and their relative weighting within the overall size of the Eurozone economy. Then Portugal gets the short end of that stick because it is a small economy with a reasonably small bond market, but not so small that the ECB has come to dominate it. And those yields are continuing to rise higher, and it is going to additionally put some pressure on the ECB as to what exactly they're going to do, because the only thing that is going to bring those yields down is direct intervention. And that is likely to remain a very clear threat in Europe, that the market is going to continue to probe the ECB. We now know that there is one rule for big countries and one for small countries. We know that they are willing to do whatever it takes. They are willing to break any rule. They're willing to fudge any set of ideals. They are willing to forego any treaty that is convenient in order to ensure that the sustainability of the euro. And the question of whether they are going to bail out Portugal or is going to be a question I think that will be answered this year. And I think it is most particularly relevant because when we look at a list of the predictions that of countries where there is going to be big questions asked this year, they are almost all on the political front. You have elections in France, the Netherlands, and in Germany, and you have I think there's one in Hungary as well. There isn't an election planned in Portugal, but those bond yields are moving higher. It suggests that there are certainly institutional investors out there betting heavily against Portugal being able to sustain its expansion. And that is despite the fact that it is due to grow this year. But there is a very clear differentiation in what is qualified as growth because most of it is from foreign demand. There is no sign of an economic recovery in the domestic economy. And part of the reason for, well, I don't think it's part, I think it's most of the reason for all of these troubles that Europe has been because they went for counter-cyclical policies at the wrong time. There is an increasing likelihood that if we do get and there is real potential that the Eurozone is going to have problems again this year, well, there is the real possibility that they will eschew the fiscal consolidation. And they will have to go for fiscal stimulus. And Germany will be opposed to that because they don't need it. In fact, German inflation is picking up. But and of course it's picking up because the euro is so weak and the German economy is doing well. Part of the reason that the German economy is doing well is for a very similar reason to why the UK or the FTSE 100 is breaking upwards. It's because global growth is not nearly as bad as people are making out. And in yesterday's audio, I mentioned that if the euro could follow through on the upside, then it would be pressuring the progression of lower rally highs. But it did not follow through on the upside. It was down a cent in here today. And that suggests that that progression of lower rally highs is still intact. And that is something that we cannot simply ignore. There is the real potential that with political problems rising and the potential for another sovereign debt crisis to just move on to another country in the eurozone, that there is little reason to expect that the euro isn't going to move lower from here. And it would really require a very clear move to break that short-term progression of lower rally highs, and more particularly to sustain a move above the trend mean, to question that view. And therefore, if you look at those European stock markets, then the potential for nominal price improvements has to be the base case. But it is quite different from the environment that we have on Wall Street, where we have evidence of not only nominal price improvement, but also the currency market, and the yield is in your favor. And that is what we used to be able to say about the emerging markets. In the decade from early 2000, as the dollar trended lower, the Asia dollar index was trending higher. And that really ended quite conclusively with a massive reaction against the prevailing trend in 2011. And that type 2 top moved into this very long and volatile type 3 top, which was completed in 2014. And there is an overextension relative to the trend mean at these levels. And this level is in the region of the 2009 low. But even if we were to look at this chart and say that yes, there is evidence of a deep oversold condition in the short term, we don't have a great deal of evidence just yet that it is has ended. That there is potential certainly for that oversold condition to be unwound. The fact that this is quite heavily weighted by the Chinese renminbi, and it is worth looking at both the onshore and the offshore. Because the onshore has not moved to nearly the extent that the offshore has. CNH is the offshore. Renminbi. And we have had a substantial appreciation in the renminbi this week. Now, it bounced today. This chart hasn't yet updated. So China certainly doesn't want a strong currency. And most particularly, they don't want a strong currency when just about everyone else is looking for a weaker currency. The US is willing to tolerate a stronger currency right now because they really don't have much choice. And the US consumer accounts for over 60% of the economy. And the US consumer is not particularly dollar sensitive. So the US is more equipped than most countries, but most particularly better equipped than China to deal with a stronger currency. And this is quite similar to what we saw last year. The Chinese moved at the beginning of 2016 to chasten the short sellers. And we have seen that this week. They intervened in the market to chasten the short sellers, to moderate the pace of the decline. We have almost seen a complete unwinding of the renminbi's oversold condition. But realistically, it would need to sustain a move below the trend mean to even begin to question that this isn't still a downtrend for the renminbi and an uptrend for the dollar. This was an awfully big week for Bitcoin. And we have had some very, very large moves. And again, this is another chart that doesn't update immediately. And I've been looking at Fiat Leak all day. I've had this chart open all day. I opened it first thing this morning because I wanted to be able to show how many Bitcoin traded today. And let's see, I opened it 8.5 hours ago, and none is the answer. No Bitcoin have traded in those 8 hours, and that is a very distinct change from what we've seen, because we know that China accounts for over 85% of all Bitcoin trading, and the central bank has reached out to the Bitcoin exchanges and told them to moderate their activity. What we have seen just the last couple of days is almost a complete cessation in Chinese trading of Bitcoin. And if you remove a massive source of demand from the market, well, then I think we can conclude that it's reasonable to expect that prices are going to come back down, and at least back towards the trend mean. In fact, that's what's happened on every other big pullback, and I don't think that there is any reason to expect that that isn't exactly what's going to happen on this case, on this occasion as well. And it really does ram home the fact that you have the potential for massive fiscal spending, which is going to increase deficits. It is going to stoke inflation. You have emerging markets where they want weaker currencies, and China has certainly been managing its currency lower. And that really does then begin to raise questions about what can we consider as hard money? And the good news is that relative to some of those currencies, hard money is cheap. Gold prices had been falling for 7, even 8 consecutive weeks, and have now put 2 weeks on the upside, bouncing from above the 1100 level. When we look at the trend for over the last 5 years, it is primarily downward. We had a massive reaction against this prevailing downtrend at the beginning of 2016. That ended in July, and we have had a substantial unwinding of that bull market. Having unwound the vast majority of the advance, we're now getting at least a reversion back up towards the mean. But I don't think you would need a PhD in chart reading to point out that there is a progression of lower rally highs that's been there since July, that there is a wide overextension relative to the trend mean, and that to really conclude that demand is back in the driver's seat beyond the short term, but into the medium term, then at least an advance back above the trend mean would be required. Well, that's $60 from here. And that we could see, and even a rally of $60 would only unwind the oversold condition. Platinum had fallen even more and has staged a more impressive rally. It has now closed its overextension, but it really does need to get back above that big psychological 1000 level to break the progression of lower rally highs. The gold shares indices have been leading on the upside, but today we saw that they paused in the region of the trend mean. They really do need to sustain a move above it. Certainly, there is room to be a bit more optimistic about the outlook for precious metals, but perhaps not when they're denominated in US dollars. If we were to look at gold in a number of other currencies, then it is obviously doing best against the weakest currencies. And the weakest currency right now is the yen. That it had strengthened up a bit yesterday, but gave back almost its entire strengthening today. And it is hovering again below this psychological level around the 120. And there really is very little to question that the Japanese need a weaker currency. They have really bet the farm on trying to reignite growth. and the quantity of JGBs is enormous. The fact that the vast majority of them are domestically owned is certainly a point in the country's favor. The fact that they have a positive trade surplus is in their favor. But what they need is domestic demand growth. What they need is a revitalized domestic economy. And if those debts are ever going to be paid back, well, the chances are that they're going to be in a substantially weaker yen. JGB yields look like they are moving higher. What we can also see is that they are back above zero. And that is a rather profound change because the Bank of Japan had said that they are not going to tolerate a yield above zero, that that was their ambition. They were going to print as many as many JGBs as was required to ensure that the yield was zero. But this continues to look like an uptrend. It would really suggest that they have abandoned their negative interest rate policy because negative interest rates are inherently deflationary. And when you're doing everything you can to stoke inflation, then it says a lot about the bureaucracy that exists within and groupthink that exists within central banks that anyone ever thought that negative interest rates would lead to inflation. So we are, if the negative interest rate experiment has failed, and it has most definitely failed, and we're seeing evidence that central banks are also coming around to that conclusion, well, then they are going to go the other way, and they are going to go for outright inflation. So, and the easy way to do that is with fiscal spending. And that very quickly puts money in people's pockets. And when people have more money in their pockets, they spend it. And if they spend it, then we get higher corporate profits. So we get a bull market, not just in the fiscal sense of the word, but we get a bull market in stocks. And that is perhaps the most likely scenario. With the potential for a bull market led by Wall Street, then that should act as a tailwind for everywhere else, because just about everywhere else has now got a competitive advantage with a stronger dollar. The stability of these currencies versus the dollar is going to be the big question, and the extent to which they can hold their value rather than appreciate against the dollar is going to be a big factor in their ability to attract investment from anywhere else. I think that we're starting to see evidence that markets like Singapore and Korea are beginning to attract investor interest once more. And of course, part of the reason that that Singapore in particular is attracting investor interest is because it is a private banking center. So the Singapore financials are breaking on the upside here. That is really quite a bullish pattern overall. And despite the fact that we have so many different opinions being expressed about China, and not least in their bond markets, where they had to suspend trading in the 10-year future because there was such selling pressure, the fact that they've had to intervene to support the currency. They've intervened in Bitcoin, then the fact that there have been so many interventions has rather, I think, deterred people from looking at the individual stocks. And I think, and I've posted these charts today, but Alibaba is bouncing from the region of its 200-day moving average. Tencent, having pulled back for much of the last quarter of last year, has bounced from the region of its 200-day moving average. And Baidu, which has been confined to this triangular pattern for the last nearly 2 years, is bouncing again from the lower side. And I get rather interested when I see these triangular patterns because they're really rather rare. When you've got this progression of high reaction lows and progression of lower rally highs, then we know that the explosion when it happens is going to be powerful. We do not know in which direction it's going to go. But right now, prices are rallying from the most recent higher reaction low. So there is certainly a lot to think about, and I think we will be we're going to have a lot to think about for much of the rest of the year. But it is a benign environment overall, despite that there is short-term risks of some consolidation. But it is certainly a time in which the interest rate differential, growth, technological advantage, and trends are very much in favor of the USA. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend. I wish all the best to all of you.